Hello and welcome to True Crime Medieval, 1,000 Years of People Behaving Badly. I'm Anne Brannan, and I'm your host in Albuquerque.
And I'm Michelle Butler in Tuscaloosa.
And today we are discussing a subject that Michelle and I put on our list of subjects. I think we did this at the very beginning, didn't we, Michelle? I'm sure we did. Because we consider it at least a crime of incredible stupidity. We're discussing that time in 1169 when Dermot McMurrough invited the Normans to come to Ireland and fight for him, which turned out, of course, in the long run, to be the Normans fighting for the Normans. Yeah, not the best idea, really. So we don't know. We think it's like not a technical crime, but we think it's a crime anyway. So we stuck it on our list and we get to talk about it today. Yay. Anything you want to say about this before I go on?
I'm pretty sure 800 years of colonization is in fact a crime. So I'm comfortable.
There you go. 800 years of colonization. Yeah. Is colonization an issue that's wrong, that's completely gone in our time? No, it isn't. No. At any rate, we're talking about Ireland today. So Dermot McMurrough was the king of Leinster, and he'd been born about 1110. Father, Donacha, was the king of Leinster, and he was also, and Dermot was one of the great-grandchildren of Brian Boru. He had a nice little lineage there. Dermot's father died in battle in 1115, fighting Donal Gar Lamach, the king of Dublin. And in 1117, Dermot McKenna, Dermot's cousin, Dermot was a very popular name, I'm just saying. Dermot McKenna was the king of Leinster along with Dublin. And when he died, our Dermot's brother, Enna, became the king of Leinster. Okay. And take a little break. This is one of those things where basically what was going on was that people were fighting one against the other. This shows up a lot in whenever we're doing Irish history from this particular piece of time. We've got a lot of this going on. At any rate, so by 1122, Enna was also the ruler of Dublin, though he was subordinate in Dublin to Turlo O'Connor, the king of Connacht. Fair enough. And revolted, though, in 1124, and he pretty much won. Torla handed him the kingship of Dublin. And then Enna died suddenly in 1126. Okay, so Turlough took Dublin back and installed his son, Connachar, as king. And our Dermot became king of Leinster on his brother's death. But Turlough opposed this, and his ally, Tiernan O'Rourke, remember this name because he shows up a lot. Tiernan O'Rourke invaded Leinster. He slaughtered livestock. He threw Dermot McMurrough out. But in 1132, Dermot took Leinster back, and he and O'Connor were peaceful for a while. Like some years. So, peaceful time of years. While he was king, by the way, he built a lot of churches and abbeys and stuff like that. He's really busy. But alas, in 1166, the High King, so we haven't even mentioned the High King yet. The way this is all set up is that there's kings, and then there's a High King. So the High King, who was Dermot's main ally, was killed after some very bad behavior on his part in violating a truce and an oath that he made to the Bishop of Armagh. At any rate, he did bad things and he got killed. And at that point, Tiernan O'Rourke, as I've mentioned before, invaded Leinster again. And the new High King deposed Dermot from the kingship of Leinster. And Dermot fled, which was actually probably a good idea. Had he been caught, what happens is you get blinded, or murdered. So at any rate, he ran. So far, so good. Nothing. We're not hating Dermot yet. However, he went to Wales, he went to England, he went to France, and he was in Aquitaine when he asked Henry II of England for help. Henry II did not actually give him anything directly, but he allowed him to go recruit. He was given permission to recruit amongst the Anglo-Normans. And so he did that. And the main nobles who agreed to help were martyr lords from the borders of Wales. So they were Anglo-Normans who were already really kind of used to being in places where, they weren't really hadn't been theirs for very long. Anyway, so Richard de Clare, for instance, Strongbow was the main one of these. He was getting older at this time, and he had, in the Civil War, he had backed Stephen. So, and Stephen hadn't come out, you know, Stephen hadn't really won. And so Strongbow, at any rate, this was a way he could kind of, they were going to be able to get some lands and whatnot. And so there was Richard de Clare, Robert Fitzstephen, Maurice Fitzgerald, and Robert de Berry. And Dermot he promised them lands. And also he promised his daughter Eva to Strongbow to marry. So they invaded. They took Wexford in May of 1169. They raided the territories of three of the other kings of Ireland. Rory O'Connor, who was the high king, was holding hostages from Leinster, including Dermot's son. He killed them all. A treaty was finally made. Dermot remained, and Dermot became the king of Leinster again, and he recognized O'Connor as high king. Yay! So everything's going to be fine, right? It's all good. And the Normans will have a little land, but mostly they'll go back to England and everything will be fine. And no, I'm sorry. Maurice Fitzgerald and Dermot then took Dublin. Strongbow sent Raymond LeGros to take Waterford, and he married Eva. And then Dermot died all of a sudden. Okay, so that's it. So the Normans were there. In 1171, Henry II sent major forces to take Ireland. I mean, because the Pope said it was okay. And there were already people there, already Anglo-Normans there. And obviously it was a place where the Anglo-Normans belonged, and which you could tell because they could take it, because that's how you know that something was supposed to belong to them, is that they got it. That's why they have England. The Pope, that was Alexander II. He backed the Anglo-Norman claim to Ireland. The Irish bishops went along with this. And the Irish bishops backed him probably because it looked like that was one way that things were going to calm down and there was going to be peace. Yeah, that was going to work. Rory O'Connor lost the high kingship and the kingship of Connacht. In 1175, the rest of the clans that had kept some kind of local control submitted. And in, so it's over. 1175, at least in name, the Anglo-Normans own Ireland. And in 1177, Henry declared his son John, who was about 10 at the time, Lord of Ireland, meaning the whole island. Even at the time, there were English chroniclers who considered the English invasion of Ireland unlawful, but, it's a done deal. So the Normans were there. They built castles. They're very good at building castles, as we know, hence all those castles in Wales. They minted coins. They introduced a bunch of crops and different animals. And in 1210, they instituted by charter English common law throughout Ireland, replacing earlier Irish laws. And, the Anglo-Normans fought amongst themselves, of course, but that's just the way it goes. From the end of the 14th century, though, until the end of the 15th century, the Norman settlements became less powerful and Gaelicized through an intermarriage. And the Norman settlements were not as important to the English at that point. However, the Tudors... So the Tudors disrupted this. Henry VIII created the Kingship of Ireland. That was the first time since Rory O'Connor had been deposed that there was a king of Ireland. So this would be Henry VIII, by the way. And the Tudors kind of reconquered Ireland. Like, in name, it was theirs anyway. They took it. This was by using the plantation system. They fought wars. They exiled Irish nobles. The province of Ulster was the most problematic for them, the most Irish of the Irish provinces. And so that's the one that they used the plantation system in most powerfully. The way it worked was that they took the land. And you could buy the land, and they were selling it to the Scots that they were trying to get out of Scotland because they were misbehaving in Scotland. My clan, the Elliots, that's why they ended up in Ulster. And what happened is that you got a really good land deal. So the land was cheap. You could buy it in Ulster. Then they got you the hell out of Scotland. And there you were in Ireland, not being Irish. You could buy it back if you were Irish, but it was at an an extraordinarily exorbitant rate. So hard to do. And the nobles, they exiled. But anyway, that's where the Scots-Irish come from. If any of us around here who say we have Scots-Irish ancestry, that's what it is. It's the Scots who were put into Ireland by the Tudors. And I think also, did James continue that? Do you remember?
What I know about this time period is Edmund Spenser and a view of the present state of Ireland, in which he unabashedly argues that the only answer to the Irish problem is to kill them all and start over. His answer to the problem of Ireland is kill all the Irish. It's such a nice country.
Yeah, it's a nice country, but it has Irish people in it.
It has Irish people in it. Remember, he had been married to an heiress who owned some land in Ireland, and they got burnt out, you know, with the pesky Irish wanting their place back.
He got
really mad about it and wrote this pamphlet, A View of the Present State of Ireland, in which he advocated genocide.
It's not as good a piece as The Fairy Queen, is it? Mm-hmm.
Or even Epithelion.
And unfortunately, unlike Jonathan Swift later, he's not actually being sarcastic, is he?
Not in the slightest. He is serious as a heart attack. That's what he thinks is the best thing to do.
Yeah, Spenser. There are many reasons I wasn't a Spenser scholar, and that might as well be one of them. And as for Dermot, okay, so what happened to Dermot? He was dead and everything. That's what happens. It's like everybody from that time is dead at this point, but he became known as Dermot Nannal, Dermot of the Strangers, Dermot of the Foreigners. You know, that's like the guy that brought the foreigners, if that's who he was. The annals of Tierney describe him as this disturber and destroyer of Ireland. And he was also described at that time as like heroic and pious and great with the ladies, although really that had a lot to do with abducting them in times of war. But amongst the Irish, at least, his reputation became that of a traitor, a devil. And I'm going to leave you, and I'm going to leave my section, and we'll move on to Michelle, who's... Every once in a while, we hit a topic that really gets Michelle exercised. I believe this is one of them. But I'm going to leave you with his obituary. Here's his obituary from the Annals of Tierney. Did you come across this?
Mm-mm. No, it's not what I was looking at.
Oh, you're going to like it. You're going to like it. Okay, so here's what the Irish at the time had to say. Dermot McMurray, current King of Leinster, by whom a trembling sod was made of all Ireland, after having brought over the Saxons, after having done extensive injuries to the Irish, after plundering and burning many churches as Kenneth, Cunard, etc., died before the end of a year after this plundering of an insufferable and unknown disease, for he became putrid while living through the miracle of God, Camilla and Finan, and the other saints of Ireland, whose churches he had profaned and burned some time before, and he died at Ferns without making a will, without penance, without the body of Christ, without unction, as his evil deeds deserved. The end.
I'm actually okay with that.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. They didn't like him. I'm okay. So often Michelle tells us all about, Michelle has two kinds of ways she generally goes. One is, you know, how did this come down in popular literature? What do we think about him now? And the other is, what did the scholars say? And I believe that this time the scholars caught you. Is this true?
That is what happened. And I know it's a little bit unusual to talk about this because it's not, you know, somebody bops somebody else over the head, but I think that the birthplace of the English imperial project and the many, many crimes that follow from that over the next few centuries is worth considering as a crime.
Okay, fair enough. A kind of like vast historical crime, and this is where it begins. Okay.
Yes, fine. There are a number of scholars who argue, such as this particular article from 2017, that argues specifically that quote, Ireland was central to Britain's first colonial expansion, and its techniques were honed in its expanded colonization around the world. This is not the only article I ran into that argues that Ireland is the first step that leads to this worldwide empire, and the techniques that they honed in Ireland are what they use to subjugate people around the world.
Because this is like, this is the second thing that the Normans have done. They were Vikings already. So, you know, so giant Viking history behind them. Let's go here and there. And but then they become, so these are the French Vikings. They're Normans. They take England, but they do it differently than they did in Ireland. Is that what's going on?
Well, they, with England, you know, they've been there for 100 years. They're thinking about that now as at least part of their empire, but they're also talking specifically, this article and the others are talking specifically about the harsh tactics that are used.
Ah, okay.
Because that's not so much in England.
William harried the North.
Yes.
There was some of that. Yeah.
Exactly. But there was also so much of a successful decapitation of the government with the in the Battle of Hastings. So many of the lords died. It was easier to step in and take over than that's different than when you're going into a place and you need to scare everybody into behaving. Some of these techniques get worked out in Scotland as well, but a little bit later because this invasion is so early. So what I was looking at is the ways in which scholars in the 19th and 20th century discuss the Norman invasion of Ireland. And I have three examples for you. I decided to keep it at three because we don't actually really need this to be, you know, hours and hours.
We need a little subset podcast. Michelle reads all the, Michelle takes down all the scholars.
So mad. Like they just kept going. You could just keep going backwards, right? Because they cite the people before them. But in particular, these ones from the late 19th, early 20th century, and then I have another one. So I have two from that time period, and then I have another from the 1970s. And they're interesting because of what's going on politically between England and Ireland at that time and how this scholarship, how this scholarship both reflects that and influences it. So, example, in the two from the 1880s into the first decade of the 20th century, the big discussion at that point was home rule.
Right.
You know, should you allow Ireland to, I don't know, maybe govern itself a little bit? Right. It's a huge, huge, huge argument going on whether England should allow Ireland to be able to govern itself even a little bit, similar to what is actually in Scotland right at the moment. Scotland is still part of the United Kingdom, but it has its own parliament and has its own president. Nicola Sturgeon just actually announced her resignation. So my first dude is John Horace Round, who lived from 1852 to 1928. He is English. This is important. For obvious reasons, but then for some, because the other two are not. He was an expert on the English peerage. He actually consulted with the monarchy. He translated part of the Domesday book. And he has a book called The Commune of London and Other Studies from 1899. And I want to read you a wee little bit of it. In fact, I'm just going to read you the last two paragraphs of the chapter about the conquest of Ireland. It's a little long, so bear with me, okay? The Normans had found England a kingdom ready-made, its people accustomed to governance and recognizing the reign of law.
Oh no, I see where this is going.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, we're not even one set. This is his conclusion.
And I know where we're going. Yeah.
We're one sentence in and we already know that things are being, you know, fudged a little bit because this is not true. It is not true that the English were accustomed to the reign of law and governance in a way that the Irish were not.
No, the Irish just had different laws.
Because
they were Ireland, kind of like the Welsh also had laws too. Before the English got there, they were Welsh laws.
In Ireland, on the contrary, the newcomers found no kindred system. It's tribal, and that word shows up over and over again.
The tribal. Yeah. Like the Normans aren't tribal. Give me a break.
But that's a word that has a different meaning in the late 19th century, and they intend the meaning they're using here. Its tribal polity had placed between its people and themselves a gulf impassable because dividing two wholly different stages of civilization. With no common foundations upon which to build, they could only hope to become Irish by cutting themselves off from their own people. If, on the other hand, they wished to substitute law and order for native anarchy, there was no indigenous machinery for the purposes such as the Norman kings had found and used in England. They had no alternative but to introduce the system they had brought with them.
They were being good. They were really being good. They were helping the Irish by bringing them Norman civilization.
The wording, that the way these things get discussed are really, really interesting, right? There's a lot of passive language discussed with the Normans that they're, one of the later ones uses the word fate, you know, as if it just like falls into the Normans' lap that they have to deal with this.
It seems to me that fate is also a kind of stand-in for God, you know, because the Pope said so too, you know, but obviously God wanted them to do these things.
Whether Ireland, this is an awesome sentence, whether Ireland, if left to herself, would even yet, i.e. by 1899, have emerged from the tribal stage of society becomes doubtful when we contemplate the persistence of the mores Hibernici, i.e. the Irish way of doing things. A comparison of the changes in our own people between the 12th century and the days of Queen Victoria, or even of Queen Elizabeth, and those discernible in the Irish people suggests relative stagnation. It clings to its ways as the peasant clings to that patch of soil which he will not leave and on which he can exist only in squalor and want. Of one thing at least we may be sure. No fonder dream has enthralled a people's imagination than that of an Irish golden age destroyed by ruthless invaders.
What's the year this is? This is
1899.
So the Irish Renaissance has already started. Okay.
Yes, and he's pushing back strongly against the idea that there was an Irish golden age before this, because that's part of what's going on with the discussion of the invasion, is what was Ireland like before this.
He's also pushing back against the idea that shows up in some of the nationalist writings from the time, that the true Irish is the Irish speaking peasant.
Yes.
You know, it puts you at a disadvantage if you're actually Patrick Pearse, but at any rate, that's, he's pushing back against that because obviously that's so uncultured and so uncivilized. Interesting.
Here we go. Here is the last paragraph of his chapter.
Oh God, it's going to be worse than that one.
It's worse. We went to Ireland because her people were engaged in cutting one another's throats. We are there now because if we left, they would all be breaking one another's heads. So let me continue here. I'm gonna skip one sentence. The leaders of the Irish people have not so greatly changed since the days when King, and he's got that King in quotation marks, King McDuncha blinded King Dermot's son, when Dermot in turn relieved his feelings by gnawing off the nose of his butchered foe. Claiming to govern a people when they cannot even govern themselves, they clamor like the Babu of Bengal against that Pax Britannica, by the presence of which alone they are preserved from mutual discussion. No doubt, as one of them frankly confessed, they would rather be governed badly by themselves than well by anyone else. But England also has a voice in the matter, and she cannot allow the creation of a pandemonium at her doors. He is an unabashed apologist for colonialism.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this is noblesse oblige. You know, we have to save these people because we are the superior culture and race.
He implicitly, he shouldn't be talking about India this way either, but he implicitly compares Ireland throughout the chapter to India, to South America, as these places of barbarism and anarchy. And, you know, he uses that word tribal a lot. And there's a complete blindness. one of the things I find really rich about this use of the word anarchy is Henry II, let's just remind ourselves how Henry II came to the throne. Henry II came to the throne as the compromise candidate after a civil war that Victorian historians labeled the anarchy.
Right, they did.
It is willfully blind to how wild the Normans fought among themselves and the state of England before the conquest. He is probably the worst of the three, just to let you know.
Okay, well, that's good. Thank you. If it's not going to get any very worse, because that's so humongously bad.
It's really, really bad. It is.
It's really nicely clear as to delineating the ways in which the English are framing the Irish, the English that wish to continue this, you know, project, that the ways in which they're framing the Irish. It's a hard, hard battle. It really is.
So the next one I have for you is slightly later. He is Dublin Irish, so Anglo-Irish. He has a four-volume work called Ireland Under the Normans. It was published between 1911 and 1920. Now, the thing that I find a little bit problematic, well, there's several things, but one of the things I find kind of problematic is our previous guy, John Horace Round, he's kind of falls by the wayside in terms of scholarship after the first quarter of the 20th century, first half of the 20th century. Orpen's Goddard Henry Orpen, O-R-P-E-N. His book was published, this four-volume work was published between 1911 and 1920. It was reprinted as is in 1968.
It
was reissued, and wait for it, it was reissued in a one-volume edition by Four Courts Press in 2005.
Oh my God.
Yes.
With any kind of note about this is a really kind of interesting old way of looking at things?
No. Okay. His book was controversial from the outset, because this is even further into the question, you know, 1911 is the lead up to the Irish War of Independence.
Yes.
It's not like things have calmed down.
No, it didn't.
So when he dropped a book and in the prologue says this, due credit has not been given to the new rulers, i.e. the Normans, for creating the comparative peace and order and the manifest progress and prosperity that Ireland enjoyed during that period wherever their rule was effective.
Okay, this is wrong and nonsense.
It is, I think, manifest that the most prominent effect of the Anglo-Norman occupation was not, as has been represented, an increase of turmoil, but rather the introduction over large periods of Ireland of a measure of peace and prosperity quite unknown before.
The Normans, a peaceful lot of peacefulness, and also really nice laws.
And later in the book, he says, although that was the really important piece, until the coming of the Normans, and then only partially, Ireland never felt the direct influence of a race more advanced than herself.
Oh, my God.
She never experienced the stern discipline, what the fuck, of Roman domination.
Republished in 2000 what?
Five!
Wow.
She never experienced the stern discipline of Roman domination, nor acquired from the lawgivers of modern Europe a concept of the essential condition of a progressive society, the formation of a strong state able to make and above all enforce the laws. See, this is not true. Ireland had laws.
Yeah.
They just
yeah.
didn't like them.
Yes.
I'm frankly troubled by his wording that worships the strong man, particularly mm-hmm. in this. I mean, we know what's coming with the First World War and then the Second World War. This language is more than a little fascist. It's I'm not liking it. But
no.
But in particular, the dropping of a prologue in which he says, you know, oh, the Anglo-Normans bought peace and prosperity. Then he gets his feelings hurt when the Irish nationalists are like, dude, you have totally hurt the cause. You have absolutely carried water for the English staying here because you said it was a good thing for us. And he opens in one of a prologue to a later volume that, you know, he's just doing scholarship. He doesn't think that this is fair at all. Not surprisingly, the Irish reviews pan the book and the English reviews praise it. And he says, I'm just doing scholarship and it has absolutely nothing to do with the contemporary debate about home rule. I don't know why you guys are being so mean to me.
Wow. That's really, you know, the thing is, all scholarship is political because the humans are political. And
yes,
so
of course.
You see things through your filter. To pretend that scholarship is not political when you've written something extraordinarily political is quite disingenuous.
One of Orpin's, it is true, right, that the line between politics and scholarship was thinner in this time, right? One of Orpin's most strident critics was a historian named Ewan McNeill, who pivots actually from being a historian to running for office. And one of his kicking off his political career speeches is absolutely flaying Orpin. Sean Duffy has a 2000 article in which he wants to rehabilitate Orpin, and he has some points that I think are bunk. Okay. One thing he tries to argue is that Orpin is not a quote unapologetic or unequivocal apologist of the invasion. That's bunk. You can't walk back.
He totally is. He says he is.
He says in the prologue, he is, you can't walk it back. No matter how else, like there are other places in the book where he shows a little bit more, you know, weighing of things, but he says in the prologue what his project is. And I think we need to take him seriously that that's his thesis. He said it is. But he does make the point, and I think this is a fair point, that Orpin is doing the best he can in the time period in which he's working. He is absolutely working through a Victorian idea about civilization and colonization. So he says things like, the Vikings bring cities. This is a good thing. He works from the assumption that cities are a good thing, and that when the Vikings bring them, as he's claiming, that's moving forward. Like, he has this idea of progress and that the Irish weren't following the standard accepted way to become a civilization, and therefore they're not as advanced. This is probably true, that he's doing the best he can. He is well read. He's read a lot of early Irish law, but his interpretation is thoroughly Victorian. When he talks, I looked at the section in particular about Irish marriage customs, which are very different than English 12th century. You know, women can ask for divorce. They have a trial marriage. Possibly, you can get married for a year and a day and then reevaluate after that whether you want to stay married. He calls them reprehensible and illicit.
It's the same kind of response that the Anglo-Normans had to the Welsh, who, you know, didn't get upset if somebody was illegitimate. I mean, they considered children children, and you might not be the first to inherit, but you were part of the inheritance.
The fact that the Irish allowed polygamy and divorce is one of the reasons that the Pope cites to give permission
Got
for
it.
The invasion. So Orpin is still a big presence, which means that, you know, his endorsement of the invasion is still very much a live issue, even though the book was written 100 years ago.
I am very surprised by that. And I'd like to say that, I mean, I get it that he's a product of his time in terms of scholarship. First of all, we don't have to reiterate him. But second of all, there's other stuff going on at the time. He would have been very familiar with the writings of the Nationalist. And so it's not like you couldn't find any other ways of thinking about things.
The last one surprised me, to be honest. The last one surprised me a little bit. It shouldn't, because I actually can kind of remember this piece of history. But this is Francis Stuart Leland Lyons. He lived from 1923 to 1983. He is also Anglo-Irish. Dublin man. He wrote a book called Culture and Anarchy in Ireland, 1890 to 1939. And it was published by Clarendon in 1979. And the paperback edition came out from Oxford University Press in 1982.
Okay. So we are no longer in the home rule.
No, we are now in the time period of IRA bombings.
We're the troubles, yeah.
Yeah. The title of the book is a reference to Matthew Arnold's book, that Matthew Arnold, the 19th century poet and scholar, Culture and Anarchy, which argues that common culture pulls societies together. Ireland, Lyons argues, does not have a common culture. Rather, there are four: the English, the Irish, the Anglo-Irish, and the Ulster Protestants. And the clash of these cultures has produced anarchy.
I see.
Yes. So my first claim, my first reaction to that is, and whose fault is that? Because three of those, if we check our notes, those came from the invasion.
Well, if the Irish should only handle the Normans better, then everything would be fine.
But, you know, he's this is, again, harkening back to the argument that they're not really civilized. Mm. So we don't have to take them seriously.
Right. You know,
word anarchy is all over all three of these sets of scholars. Or the work of these scholars, that Ireland is anarchic. And therefore, in fact, actually, I should have mentioned this with Orpin. His chapter about Ireland before the invasion is called Anarchic Ireland, 9th to 11th centuries.
So the idea is that Ireland is an anarchy because it does not have Norman laws. And then later, Ireland is an anarchy because it is fighting against English colonization. Okay.
We've covered some murders happened in early Ireland. It is true, right? Like we talked about how rough and tumble early Ireland is. The part I'm objecting to is not that. It's that that is different somehow than what's happening in Francia, that's what's happening in Italy, then, you know, all of that early Europe.
All killing each other. We've also had several podcasts about the Franks killing each other, and several podcasts about the Italians killing each other, and some podcasts about the Scandinavians killing each other. I mean, it's not like the Irish are like different here.
They're not special.
Just being of their time. They can't help being of their time.
So the quote from him that I want to share with you is this, because this book isn't about the early Ireland. It's about 1890 to 1939. But he has this to say: if they, the Anglo-Irish lords, were arrogant, it was because it had been their fate to govern a people which, for much of its history, had shown little capacity to govern itself. And again, this is one of these word moments, right? Fate.
Yep.
It became their Anglo-Saxon burden. Isn't this what they say about colonization, the white man's burden?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it was their fate.
Mm-hmm. And God is involved because fate.
He's less strident, but in some ways, this kind of nonchalance is almost more irritating. And also, it's 1979.
Yes.
The other piece of this book that is fascinating and really points up the time period we're dealing with is that it won a literary prize called the Christopher Ewart Briggs Memorial Prize. It's named for Christopher Ewart Briggs, who was the English ambassador to Ireland. And he'd been in the country for 2 weeks when he was killed by an IRA bomb in 1976. His family established the prize in 1977. And here I'm going to quote from Wikipedia. Its stated goal is to promote peace and reconciliation in Ireland, a greater understanding between the peoples of the United Kingdom and Ireland, or closer cooperation between partners of the European community. It is awarded to a book, a play, or a piece of journalism that best fulfills this aim. Okay. But if you go and look at the list of prize winners, and this prize is still being given out, by the way. It's been given since 1976, and the list that I was looking at covers till 2021. So I assume it's still happening. Uh-huh. Because why would it suddenly have stopped anyway? But I don't think that the 2022 one has been announced yet. Anywho, when you look at the list of prize winners, it tends towards Northern Irish and English sympathizing. Very, very few winners are from the rest of Ireland.
Ireland proper, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's a literary prize that has a stated goal, but appears to actually be given to people who want to toady up to England, to be blunt.
Right. Well, and the whole idea of peace, the idea of peace here is not peace because England changes, but because Ireland behaves itself.
So I found this topic to be just utterly fascinating, because this is one of these places where you have like world pivoting sort of moments. Dermot's anger at being deposed leads him to go make a criminally stupid decision and think he's gonna invite the Normans in and somehow still gonna end up king, which any cursory knowledge of them as a people would have dissuaded you from believing that. And then it has, you know, it leads to the huge crime of the invasion and the colonization, which goes on for centuries. And then, you know, that's still a live issue by the time we get down to the scholarship of the 19th and 20th century. And you really would think that 800 years later, we were able to kind of look back and work with it dispassionately, but clearly not. It is still too relevant to the discussion.
I think that one of the issues is not just that this has to do with the Norman conquest of Ireland, but that the way in which it happens is so easy to blame the Irish in general for what Dermot does. You know, well, you know, if they were only just like not so anarchic and they wouldn't have to invite the Normans, because yes, it really is Dermot McMurrow's fault that the Normans ended up there. Maybe they would have ended up there later, but this is how it happened. But it's not the whole rest of the country saying, hey, let's get the Normans over here because they could fix things. I'm reminded of that time that Scotland says to Edward, hey, will you come solve our succession problem? And Edward says, yes, if you'll be my vassals. And they say, okay. And then guess what? You know, Anglo-Normans, Scotland.
Yeah, that's another criminally stupid moment.
That was a parliamentary thing. It wasn't like one person said, would you come help me get my stuff back? Which is highly selfish.
Should have known Edward the First well enough by then to know.
Oh yeah, it's not like nobody knew who he was. Yeah, no. They knew him. Yeah, and the Normans. I love this idea that the Normans bring culture and law, because of course they do have culture, they do have law like everybody else in Europe. And but they're also killing each other too. They fought amongst themselves in Ireland, they fought amongst themselves in Normandy, they had been having a giant civil war in England, you know.
Yeah, I'm deeply, deeply enjoying the word anarchy being all over this scholarship, when and no recognition of the civil war that had just happened, which they call the anarchy. The Victorians are the ones who name it that. But yeah, it's all of this stuff is allowed to exist in Ireland and conveniently forgotten. This does, of course, you know, I always end up referring back to Tolkien, but it does provide some really interesting background for me when he says to himself, boy, the Normans really screwed up everything. He's really pushing against the tide here, scholarly. From a scholarly point of view, when he takes that perspective, that is not how people are thinking about it at this point.
Yet another reason to think highly of Tolkien. Tolkien, he goes his own way. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Well, yeah. So, yeah, we knew that we were going to have a lot to say We knew that we were going to probably get sort of emotional. We did not know that we would have to, you know, take on scholars, but there you go. Because we didn't look at all as like, does this come down into popular what's it? Did we? Whoops.
It does. There is historical fiction. I just, I got sidetracked immediately into the, they said what now? somebody said out loud that the Normans brought peace and prosperity. Really?
After that, everything was really great, except when people were being, you know, not very happy and understanding how great the Normans were.
I mean, it's one thing. I see people sometimes, you know, who justify invasions by saying, well, you know, that's just how it works. Survival of the fittest. If you can walk in and take a place, then it's yours. That is one way, you know, and fine, that's at least intellectually consistent. But trying to tell me with a straight face that the Normans brought peace and prosperity to Ireland is hard for me to wrap my brain around.
Yeah. And the idea that the Irish didn't have laws, and that their system of government was, you know, anarchic or tribal, you know, just or primitive, because that's what tribal is meaning in this context.
And I think this is an important topic for Americans to be familiar with, because everybody still has such strong feelings about it 800 years later. And we try to tell each other, just get over it. You know, it's been 50 years. Get over it. It's been 100 years. You know, why are people so unhappy about the fact that there was slavery in the U.S.? Nobody cares about that anymore. And, you know, I was just reading the other day that the President Tyler, who was born in 1792, has a living grandchild alive right now. Holy crap. He's still alive. He's 90, but he's still alive. I mean, we're a young country. We're such a young, you know, this version of, there's not enough continuity between, because we did it on purpose, between what the Native Americans had and, you know, what got set up. So from the English construct colonial government, that's a very short history. And man, oh man, is this a learning moment for how long things can have ramifications. Plus, it was a crime. I mean, I'm just going to be real firm on the idea that I think colonization is a crime. Stay in your own damn country.
I believe that as a podcast, we stand for no colonization. Understanding the vexed history behind us, yes. And this is why we support Ukraine in the Russian invasion of Ukraine. We're thinking about a lot about that these days. And I'm thinking about, you know, methods of colonization. The idea that the invading force, you know, we're the colonizers and we have the culture and we have the language and we have the right laws and we have history behind us. It's like, it's all very well and good unless you're looking at it from the other side, in which case none of those things are true.
Yeah. At some point, we should do a later podcast about the really, really genocidal moves by the Tudors to
let's do that.
To try to suppress Irish culture, because I was just reading this week that Paul Mescal is an actor who's at the BAFTAs, and he gave an interview in Irish, and it was a sensation because only about 2% of the Irish population is Gaeltacht. You know, speaks Irish as their native language. So did, give me a second, Brendan Gleeson, but he's a little bit older and he's from a Gaelic speaking part of Ireland. So that didn't make as many waves as when Paul Mescal did. But both of these interviews kind of became a big deal. And there's an Irish speaking film up for an Oscar for best foreign language film. But this is a result of deliberate actions taken by the English government in the 19th century. The understanding was if they could get rid of the Irish language, they could get rid of the Irish culture. It's the same approach that was taken with the Native Americans, where you're beating children for speaking their own language.
Speaking of which, one of the languages that has not disappeared is Welsh. It's amazing because Welsh is not dead, nor is it nor is it marginal. So it's possible. It's possible to keep it or to bring it back. It's possible.
The articles I was reading about those interviews being done in Irish were talking about how they were feeling like they needed to have a discussion about how it's taught, because Irish is taught compulsorily in school.
It's not anymore. It was.
It was not being taught in ways that lead to
right.
people using it for conversation. It was more being taught as almost like a dead language.
Yeah, it was. It really was. So, you know,
I didn't know that they dropped the requirement.
They dropped the requirement, which really was not working. It was making to make a language compulsory
yeah.
does not work any better than to making a language illegal. Mm-hmm. They're both vexed. And so, yeah, Wales didn't do that. It went in a different direction.
I'm pleased to report I have studied Irish enough that when I watched the Brendan Gleeson's interview, I understood two whole words. Go team.
when I was learning Irish, I had some various different books. And one of my favorite ones was a little pamphlet. It was created for parents of children who were in the schools and therefore learning Irish in the schools. And so you wanted as a parent to be able to talk with them. So it had a whole lot of useful phrases like where's the ball and please eat your oatmeal. But my favorite two were you are a right monkey, you, and also get down off the curtains or I will kill you. I thought that was interesting to be able to say in Irish.
Things you need to know. Curtains.
Because its languages are hard. Oh, you know, but at any rate, you can learn Irish on Duolingo and you can learn Welsh on Duolingo. And right now, Duolingo is having a vast impact. There's a whole lot of people learning Ukrainian, which I will tell you is, for me, harder than Irish and harder than Welsh. It's like a whole nother thing because it's off from a different piece of the world and from where the languages I know come from. And boy, but it's possible. It's possible.
I'm still working through Irish.
Irish is a good language.
That's all a big sidebar. There were so many crimes. So many crimes. I felt bad about this originally, but I don't feel bad anymore because this is the spark to so many crimes.
Did you feel bad about it? Because it felt like it wasn't actually a crime. It was just somebody making a bad mistake.
I felt a little bit bad about it. And I wanted to talk about it anyway, but I felt a little bit bad about it, that maybe we were slipping something in. But no, this is moment zero for a whole lot of crimes.
It's just so inevitable. Yes, thank you for the land, Mr. McMurrow. And it's like, and here's Henry II. Da, 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 da. Just like, what did you think? We'll just take everything now. Thank you very much. It was a bad idea. Yeah, and so now we have history, and you and I are both products of that history and a bunch of others, and here we all are, and yeah. Anyway, so the moral of all this is, if you are having a big problem because your neighbor has stolen your house, do not go and get the mafia to come in and help you. Be careful who your allies are. This is the moral.
I do wonder, just a sidebar, I wonder about the stories, you know, about how Vortigern invited in the Anglo-Saxons. Like, I wonder what the time frame is in which we see those emerge, because the parallels are just inescapable.
I'm lost here. What are we talking about?
The early Arthurian stories.
Oh, the Arthurian. Right. Because I was like, Vortigern. Because there's actually a Welsh person named. Okay, fine. Okay. the Arthurian Vortigern. Okay. Yes, yes.
Yeah. So either Dermot, had it been reading the stories he should have been reading about the dangers of inviting foreign mercenaries in.
They wouldn't have existed for him. He didn't have them. Mm-mm, no. We don't have them written down even until later in Welsh.
Because it's right there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Don't do that. They'll take the
don't
place.
Don't do that. Don't invite the Romans. Invite the English. Don't invite the Americans.
Well, it's super logical, right? If you're weak enough to have to invite somebody else in for help, of course they're going to do the calculus and say, well, why don't we just take it for ourselves?
Yeah,
why should we help you?
We'll help. will help a lot.
If you're weak enough to need help, you're not strong enough to keep it, so.
That's the problem. Yeah, okay, so, yeah, if really indeed the whole point is that the strongest should, you know, by right have what they can, then all of this is just fine. But I don't think so. I think really the strongest should just behave themselves. That's where I'm at.
Well, this argument gets hauled out most with the conquest of, you know, the Native American land.
Oh, sure.
Here, you know. Yeah. Well, they didn't deserve to keep it because they didn't defend it.
Yeah. And also they didn't have any culture. Oh, for the love of God, they most certainly did. Anyway, just not yours. And they thought about, you know, land is wholly different. So this was our discussion of the Anglo-Norman invasion of Ireland, which we stuck on to our discussion of Dermot McMurrow, Dermot Nunyall. He's the Dermot of the strangers, because that's where he threw his lot. The next time that you hear from us will be where we have we'd like to do a April Fool's podcast about a thing which just did not exist. And this year we are going to do, Michelle found this, we're going to do the shame flute. Is that what we're talking about, Michelle?
Yes, I suspect this is not a real thing, but I think we're going to go find out whether it was a real thing. It gets discussed as if it was a real thing.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes we find out that things actually were real. Like we didn't think the Pied Piper of Hamelin was real, and the Pied Piper isn't, but the children disappearing is. And so, you know, you find things out, you know. Anyway, we'll do the shame flute next time. And this has been A True Crime Medieval, where the crimes are just like they are today. Oh, God, they're just like they are today, aren't they? Just like they are today, only with more technology, as, for instance, you know, tanks and javelins. We can be found on Spotify and Stitcher and Apple Podcast and all of the places where the podcasts are hanging out. And you can find us, if you want to get a hold of us, you can find us on truecrimemedieval.com. True Crime Medieval is all one word. And we have links to podcasts and show notes and transcripts there. And and you can leave comments there too. And we'd love to hear from you. And if you have medieval crimes that you think we might do well to look at, please let us know. We got a lovely, lovely suggestion the other day. We often do we do special episodes where we go out of the Middle Ages and into the early modern, but we haven't done a special episode when we leave Europe and go elsewhere. And this is one from the Middle East, and so that might be a weird thing. Ooh, it's a blood feast too. Yay! Do love a blood feast, and we haven't had one for a while, so you know.
That's true.
I think a blood feast would do us good, so we're going to put that on the list. Yeah. That's what we'll do. Do we have anything else? I think that's it.
I think I should probably behave myself, honestly. I was so mad. My kid probably was like, what on earth is going on? Because I'm like, what? What?
I enjoy it when you get exercise, so I'm all right with it. See you later. Bye.
Bye.